2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 51, a panel discussion, Mormon Feminist Literature Review, with Mary Ellen Robertson, Carolyn Pearson, Levina Fielding Anderson, and Nadine Hansen.
We'll go ahead and get started. This is the session, which is formally entitled, From the Best Books, A Review of Literature in Feminist Spirituality. And I will go ahead and introduce our panelists, and then we'll get started on the meat of the session. My name's Mary Ellen Robertson. I put together this panel, and I'll be serving as moderator as well as a panelist. And when I was in school, I ran across a lot of new readings in feminist spirituality that I wouldn't have encountered any other way. And since I've been out of school and not circulating among academics quite as much, I've kind of felt like maybe I'm not on the cutting edge of what's happening in the scholarship anymore. And I envisioned this panel as a way to get us circulating ideas among ourselves, talk about the books that have influenced us. I'm definitely hoping for some audience participation at the end of this session. But I was hoping, especially because as Mormons in general, we tend to be sort of isolated from things, trends, ideas that are happening in other religious groups in general, just because we kind of tend to be self-focused. And that can be a good thing, too. But what I had hoped this panel would do is cross-pollinate everyone here with some new and interesting titles in feminist spirituality, maybe introduce you to some of the classics that you may not have picked up before. And especially, I wanted to hear some of the stories about how some of the books that we've selected as panelists to talk about have touched us personally and contributed to our spiritual growth and the journeys that we've been on. And kind of the third part of this is I've put together a list of suggested readings that I'll hand out at the end, so you'll listen to what the speakers have to say during the session instead of reading that. So it's not an exhaustive list, but it's a good place to start in case you're new to this area, you want to know more. You'll get a good cross-section of some of the things that are out there and can spawn possibly future discussions. And I think I'll have enough copies for everyone here today. And the book list is already kind of cross-pollinated with some of the panelists because some of the things that the panelists have written are on the book list. So you'll get a chance to hear a little bit more about that. The panelists may be too modest to talk about their own work, but the other panelists may take care of some of that for them. So I'll go ahead and introduce us panelist folk, and we'll go ahead and speak in the order, I guess, that we're listed in the program. Like I said, my name is Mary Ellen Robertson. I'm from Pasadena, California. I have a master's degree in women's studies and religion from the Claremont Graduate School, and I just found my own biography, so maybe I'll read it from that instead of trying to remember all this stuff. I have a bachelor's in English and journalism from BYU, and I've worked as everything from a reading writing tutor, copy editor, reporter, teaching assistant, and substitute teacher before I started my career at JPL in first information technology and now contract administration. I'm also a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. Carolyn Pearson, if you heard her wonderful speech at lunch, you've already heard the lovely vita that we have on her. She's from Walnut Creek, lives there now, is a professional writer, speaker, and performer, author of numerous books that we have loved and are on the book list, including Goodbye, I Love You, Consider the Butterfly, Transforming Your Life Through Meaningful Coincidence, and Mother Wove the Morning. So we'll look forward to some of the selections that she has to share with us. And someone might talk about some of her works. Actually, I know someone will because that's me. Levina Fielding Anderson from Salt Lake City is the president of Editing Incorporated, an editor of the Journal of Mormon History, editor of Lucy's book, a critical edition of Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir, and currently researching Lucy's Life, a biography of Lucy Mack Smith. She has a PhD in English from the University of Washington, and also has a long and wonderful vita of things that she's published and been involved with, also on our list of books that you'll be seeing a little bit later on. And the last is Nadine Hansen, who is currently living in Cedar City, Utah, and is a semi-retired attorney and member of Sunstone's board of directors. Do you want me to add anything to that? There's a little line saying, "This is all the participant gave us. Talk to her beforehand." So, all right. Well, then we're covered. Okay. I'll go ahead and say a few things. I've already kind of introduced what I had hoped to accomplish in putting this panel together. Again, to kind of cross-pollinate us with ideas and good books to read and things that might inspire us, provoke us to action, irritation, or good works, things like that. And so I'm hoping that will be what happens as a result of this session. And at very least, we'll have a good, lively discussion after all the panelists have spoken. I'm going to just lift wholesale the first part of my remarks from the introduction to my master's thesis, which was on Mormon women's spiritual gifts and priesthood authority and the relationship of those two things historically. And basically, my fascination with Mormon women's history had an odd and accidental genesis. While waiting for the rest of my family to assemble for reunion, I wandered into a bookstore in Logan, Utah, where I happened upon a gently used copy of Mormon Sisters, which I have here. And I admit I was a little annoyed that the cover price was $4.95 and they were charging $5 for it. I was young, so we'll write that off as that. And a copy of Mormon Sisters, : Women in Early Utah, because you can't have an academic book without a colon in the title. In this anthology were stories that I'd never heard at church, tales of Mormon women running for political office, attending medical school, adjusting to the formidable role of plural wife, teaching school, claiming feminism, dealing with prejudice and persecution, and exercising spiritual gifts. Mormon history seemed to make only passing mention of these women. You might get a few of the notables, but not really any meat. So only passing mention of these women and their accomplishments, and essentially relegated their stories to either footnotes or obscurity. And yet here was a volume that celebrated the tenacity and wide-ranging impact of Mormon women in the early days of church history. And I pored over this book, and I wanted more. And I'm grateful that I stumbled into Mormon women's history at a fortuitous moment. At that time, the 20-year-old women's movement had made inroads into the Mormon community and had piqued the interest of Mormon women who began to reflect on their own status in the church as well as the status of their foremothers. A number of Mormon women scholars began to train an academic eye on their church's history and culture. Their voices, their scholarship, and their writings laid the groundwork for continued faithful scrutiny of many aspects of their religious tradition, and most importantly, reclaimed their largely unsung sisters from obscurity. Maureen Ersenbach Beecher noted one of the purposes in these reclamation efforts in the preface to the anthology devoted to Mormon women, saying, "May our past be a preface to a continually enlightened future." Amen. With this sentiment in mind, I embarked on my work in an aspect of Mormon women's history that I found fascinating. That was Mormon women's use of spiritual gifts in early church history. So this is the book that lit my fire. And I didn't really know that I was starving for something like this until I read this book and it fed me. And this one was the volume that provided me definitive proof that Mormon women were and are more than the sum of their parts, more than their wombs, more than the fruit of their loins, and more than their testimonies. I was ecstatic to learn that the book was recently reprinted, and I will always cherish this volume, much loved, much underlined and annotated, as my first love and my first introduction to the inspirational Mormon women of the past. And that applies to the authors in this volume as well as their subjects. Attending BYU turned me into a full-fledged feminist, and in many ways I credit this book for turning me into an academic, a historian, and a seeker. I could not have written the thesis I did on Mormon women's spiritual gifts without this book, and without Carolyn Pearson's book, Daughters of Light, which guided my way and talked about, in some depth, Mormon women's use of spiritual gifts and their experiences with healing and blessing each other and speaking in tongues. And these were spiritual experiences that they cherished enough to make records of and write down. And I want to personally, since we're all here, offer my profound thanks to you for writing Daughters of Light, for compiling all of the information that was in there that collected these experiences in one place. And I, you know, after having sat in the archives for many, many hours trying to track down some of the things that other people had already collected, I don't know how you did it if you were starting from scratch. You know, I was really fortunate to have some of these foundational works already in existence, and for that I thank you with all my heart. I'm going to talk a little bit, you know, I could wax on and on about this book, but what I think I'll do with my remaining time is to just give you a taste of the books that I most often recommend to other people for a broad introduction to Mormon women's studies. The books I recommend most often for an overview of feminist spirituality, not necessarily Mormon, but what other religious feminists are doing and thinking about. And I'll briefly touch on books I hope will become my new favorites. And these are the ones that I haven't finished or started reading yet, but I have high hopes for enjoying. Of the first group, since I've done work in Mormon women's spiritual gifts, I tend to get a lot of requests saying, oh, well, you've done work in this. What do you recommend? You know, I'll get emails from graduate students who are just kind of dipping their toes in these waters. And the book I most often send them to is Maxine Hanks's anthology, Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. And it's a collection of contemporary and historical writings by Mormon women regarding faith, spirituality, feminism, and all the places that takes them. The other work that I also highly value is Sisters in Spirit, Mormon Women in Historical and Cultural Perspective, that was edited by Maureen Ersenbach Beecher and Levina Fielding Anderson. Again, that's another, you know, dog-eared, much dragged around, loved book that I think really situates Mormon women not only within their own religious tradition, but what was going on in the world around them. Gives a better taste of that. And again, I'll plug Carolyn Pearson's work, Daughters of Light, which focused on Mormon women's history and spirituality and collected a lot of women's spiritual writings about their own experiences, again, with blessing and healing each other and speaking in tongues, the things that women in the early church really prized, because a lot of them came into Mormonism because, you know, the other religions of the time weren't recognizing the need for or appreciation of these kinds of ecstatic religious experiences. You know, the Mormons were going back to the Bible and saying the gifts of the Spirit that are talked about in the Bible, we embrace here and now. And a lot of people really valued that and felt that was missing from other religions at the time. the books that I most often recommend for the overview on feminist spirituality in general are, there are two by the same couple of authors. Women's Spirit Rising, A Feminist Reader in Religion, edited by Carol P. Christ and Judith Plaskow, and a follow-up volume, Weaving the Visions, New Patterns in Feminist Spirituality, because there was too much to say in just one volume, so they did another one. And one of the books that I recommend for an idea about what was happening with women in early Christianity is a book by Karen Jo Torgerson called When Women Were Priests, Women's Leadership in the Early Church and the Scandal of Their Subordination in the Rise of Christianity. So for anyone who's ever heard that women weren't really all that involved in the early days of Christianity, or if you get Paul quoted at you, like I have sometimes, about, you know, women keeping silent in church and all that sort of thing, this book gives a particularly different picture of what women in early Christianity were doing and involved in. And the author went and studied funeral and memorial inscriptions on tombs and various things that talked about what women in early Christianity were doing by what people wrote basically on their headstones, or what approximated the headstones then. And, you know, just found out that you know, women in early Christianity were not just sitting around. They were very much involved in the structure of the early church, much more so than we ever hear about. So that's one of my favorites too. And my pile of to read or partway through reading, that stack includes a book called At the Root of This Longing, Reconciling a Spiritual Hunger and a Feminist Thirst, because I think for me that just even the title speaks to kind of the personal struggles that I've had with, you know, trying to reconcile what I feel spiritually with, you know, the roadblocks and things that I run into as a self-described feminist. Sometimes that doesn't go over real well at church, or people will say, well, if you're a feminist, you can't really be, you know, devout or spiritual, or, you know, folks seem to think that those don't really go together. And here's an author who's saying, yeah, they can, and they do. So I'm looking forward to getting a little deeper into that one. Another one is entitled Through the Narrow Gate by Karen Armstrong, and it's one of three memoirs that she's written from her time as a Catholic nun, describing both the entry and exit from convent life and what she learned before, during, and after that period in her life. And there's another book that I think I think it's been more widely known, I think, in Christian circles. It's called Searching the Scriptures, A Feminist Introduction by Elizabeth Schuchler Fiorenza. And she goes into talking about how, you know, how we can find feminine examples in the scriptures, how feminists can search the scriptures, which are, you know, traditionally very male-focused, and find nuggets of value therein for themselves and for others that can, you know, add to the spiritual dimensions of our lives. So those are my book list items. And like I said, I'll have the book list available at the end for everyone to take part in. And let's see, who's up next? Yeah, I think, yeah.
Thanks for doing this. It is important for us to be able to acknowledge the books that have helped us so much. I guess my own feminist awakening happened before there were any books available to my particular grasp. I'm sure there were some, but I couldn't reach any of them. I was asking difficult questions in junior high school and high school, and before Betty Friedan wrote her Feminine Mystique that kind of blew everything open, I was thinking and articulating somewhat some of these heavy questions that we've been considering. So I guess my first memories about books on this order were the books that did not nourish me at all, that I was that I found myself desperately trying to find something in them. In college at BYU, and I guess my hunger was sufficiently whetted that I, just on my own, I went to I think it was the fourth floor of the BYU library where all the church books were. And by that time, my hunger to know something about the place of woman in this divine plan that we have going and the possible place of a heavenly mother, those were so driving to me that without assignment from anybody, I would spend hours going up and down all the books by the brethren. I can just see those shelves, those dark, dark shelves. And I went up and down all. I got very good at quickly browsing. I would pick up a book, flip to the index, quickly go down M for Mother in Heaven, quickly go to the W for women. If there was any little crumb about women, any little, totally pathetic, any little crumb in any of those books by the brethren, I would read it. I would write it down. I would think, oh, maybe, you know, there's something. So those are my non-nourishing books. And I continued my reading wherever I found something out there in the world. There wasn't very much in the church, but out there in the world, there would occasionally be a few little enticing historical tidbits that were interesting. But a major moment occurred for me in 1976, my little family of myself and Gerald, my husband, and our four little children moved from Walnut Creek to California. One reason, because I thought we were going to be going through something rather large, and I didn't want to do it in Utah. And there was kind of a new open feeling of inquiry in California. But I remember the day that Gerald came home from a day in San Francisco, and he said, "Oh, Blossom, I found something for you. You will be so excited. When I saw this in the window of the store, I knew it was for you, and so I had to get it." And he handed me this book, When God Was a Woman, by Merlin Stone. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's high heresy. That's so exciting. And I remember just sitting and just devouring this book, just thinking, you know, I can hardly believe that somebody has actually tracked this little mysterious concept that there used to be there used to be a goddess that everybody was aware of. And so I underlined this, and I just couldn't put it down. It was really so thrilling to me just to walk through history with Merlin Stone here, finding the lost goddesses of all the various cultures, Now, here there were four things that seemed to be me so exciting that I had to put big stars by them. And anyway, this particular book to me was a huge gift, just a gift to let me know that things were not right, that today was not the only day that has ever existed, that what we now say we know was not the only truth that has ever existed, that things have been lost that correlated so deeply with my personal hungers. Oh, well, prior to that, after I spent all my time with the non-nourishing books on the fourth floor of BYU Library, when Leonard Arrington was doing such fine work and speak and writing, and I don't know if it was in something he wrote or something that that he said in a talk or that he and I talked about in person. And also at that time, the Exponent 2 was happening. So there were synchronistically a number of things that were going on. But when it was through Leonard Arrington that I discovered the Woman's Exponent, the real, true, old Woman's Exponent. And I thought, wow, I need to find this. So again, I was up there in the special collections at BYU, and I have such a clear memory of sitting in one of those little carrels and going through these old pages and reading these voices and the strength of what they were saying. They're clearly independent personalities. They're clearly unique, searching voices that were not, oh, please, dear brethren, may we, but, you know, they were just there, just saying what they thought and making their own pronouncements. And I remember walking home down the hill to where we lived on 6 North and 6 East after reading maybe my first day of hours of going through all of those. And I remember being two things. I was just ecstatic to have discovered all these women and their voices. And simultaneously, I was outraged, furious and angry and outraged that nobody had ever given them to me before. Ever. I thought that is a sin, that is unconscionable. So that was in our Utah time. That was the good thing. Not necessarily books, but those writings in Woman's Exponent that were very powerful for me. And then coming to California, and in the 70s, this book is copyrighted 76, the same year that we moved here. So it would have been right then or the next year that I received that. And then it was just an explosion soon after that of all of these interesting books that took it one way or the other. But the whole subject of women's history and women's religious spiritual history, and it was very, very exciting to try to even keep up with some of the books that came out. Another one that I found very personally interesting and satisfying was The Chalice and the Blade by Rhianne Eisler. I didn't bring that one along with me. But it looks at essentially the history of Crete as a possible example. Well, not only that, but the part I remember is looking at Crete as a possible example for a time in history when we didn't have matriarchy, the flip side of whatever we could call patriarchy, which likely never existed, but where there was the outline somehow of what we might envision as a partnership society. where women and men seem to be able equally to give their gifts to the culture, and which evidenced in a culture that was very peaceful and artistic and having so many of the qualities that we would hope to have in our culture. Another book that I just was so excited to find. A minute ago when I told my son, John, I was coming in to do this thing about books. He said, well, what books are you mentioning? And I said, well, and the Hebrew Goddess. He said, oh, did they have one? See? My son said that. The Hebrew Goddess by Raphael Patai was first given to me, are you ready to be envious, by my home teacher. He had been my bishop. Excellent, wonderful man who passed away 10, 12 years ago. Robert Anderson, dear, dear, smart, good man. As I was talking to him, you know, and when he and his wife came home teaching, we didn't get any usually messages. He would bring exciting thoughts from out in the world of what was happening in the world that we ought to be thinking about and how it related to our spiritual development. It was just awesome. So when I was telling him that I was doing research for what became Mother Wove the Morning, he said, oh, I have a book I have to give you. So he gave me his copy, and I subsequently bought my own copy of The Hebrew Goddess. And in fact, as I wrote the first draft of the play, and he came to the very first reading in my house where I read the whole thing, he was thrilled with it. But he said, now, it was from this book that I developed the character of Rachel sitting on the teraphim, that I have being her connection with the lost goddess. And afterwards, he was just thrilled, but he said, couldn't you have made Rachel even more strong as a woman? You know, that dear man gave me a blessing for the success of my play. And in that blessing, he said that I was doing a work that was contributing to something that was as important as the recent coming down of the Berlin Wall. Don't you wish you had a home teacher like him? But in this particular book, The Hebrew Goddess, and I won't take much time except to just give you a couple of tantalizing, I mean, you know, for a woman who has been so hungry for so long, to get something right in our tradition. You know, you can say Merlin Stone is a pagan over there, but when you get right down to what the Hebrews had in our own spiritual genealogy, you know, that's something else. So, okay, the god of Judaism is undoubtedly a father symbol and father image, possibly the greatest such symbol and image conceived by man. Nor can there be any doubt as to the greatness of the psychological need answered by this image. Comparative religion, however, teaches us that there is in man and woman an equally great, or possibly even greater, need for yet another symbol, that of the divine woman, who appears in many different forms throughout the world, yet remains basically the same everywhere. Oh, I was excited to read some of this stuff. There can be no doubt that the goddess to whom the Hebrews clung with such tenacity down to the days of Josiah, and to whom they returned with such remorse following the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, was, whatever the prophets had to say about her, no foreign seductress, but a Hebrew goddess, the best divine mother the people had to that time. And then to learn, all we know of these, you know, Asherah and the other words that would be what she became, that just shows how far those people had fallen. But if you trace it back, it's not that way at all. And to know that that for no less than 236 years, or almost two-thirds of the time, the statue of Asherah was present in the temple. Of the 370 years during which the Temple of Solomon stood, no less than two-thirds of that time, Asherah was present in the temple as a dignified god. So I didn't know any of this stuff. I was just so hungry as I devoured all this and learned of the Shekhinah, whom, of course, I put into my play, and all the other things. And, of course, as has been mentioned already here, going up to today, the books keep coming out more and more and more in different directions, but of the same thing, of validating our need for a female deity and to revisit altogether women in religion. So I'm very grateful for these books and so many others, and I've had my little tiny part in, like, putting out that play of mine has been very thrilling. So anyway, thank you.
As I confessed to Mary Ellen, my favorite book is usually the one I've just finished reading. But as I thought about books that have been important to me in my spiritual journey as a feminist, I found myself looking over the literary landscape of the past, littered with many books on many subjects, and asking a different set of questions about them. The first of these questions was, what does spiritual mean in this context? My definition of a spiritual life is one that is oriented toward God, that recognizes and cherishes the relationship between me and God, and that strengthens and deepens my own ability to discern God's will in my life, to feel the joy and love that comes from that relationship, and to find ways of serving others. The three books on my list, I gave them each 5 minutes apiece, are all books that have furthered this quest, but I realized that they do not really describe the author's spiritual experiences, list spiritual techniques such as prayer and meditation, or record mystical experiences like the visions and manifestations of Julian of Norwich, Teresa of Avila, or the teachings of Mother Teresa. Instead, what they all have in common is that they are records of spiritual strength, of women who were strong in spirit, but they are all quite different, as I hope to show you. The first book, except that they're all Mormon, the first book I want to talk about is the most recent, Judy Busk's The Sum of Our Past, Revisiting Pioneer Women. This was the book I had most recently finished when Mary Ellen asked me to be on the panel. It's literarily and structurally very interesting. Judy and her husband of, I'm guessing, 30 years, load their van with supplies, Granny Pechtel's patchwork quilt, and Judy's research on 19th century Mormon women, and set off on a self-guided tour of church history sites. With this focus on women, it is also Judy's conscious exploration of the meaning of her life and marriage, lived in both the shelter and the shadow of the women's movement. When I was talking with Judy at the Association for Mormon Letters meeting last month in Salt Lake City, she said that her daughters have mixed feelings about how candid this book is. They say, "Mom writes a book and we have to go into the witness protection program." One of the things that Judy talks about very candidly is her programming to be a Mormon mother. There's a wonderful vignette of her dressing up with her best friend at age 10 and strolling through Liberty Park in our mother's high heels, our mouths smeared with red lipstick, our undershirts stuffed with Kleenex, pushing our Betsy Wetsy dolls in buggies. Neil saved Judy from senior panic at BYU by giving her a diamond the Christmas before they both graduated, and she seemed to be launched. But they had to make a life in a world they were no longer programmed for. She talks about the ambivalence of believing fascinating womanhood, but discovering Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. Quote, "My fascinating self could wear ruffled nightgowns and be prolific in baby production." They had six children, one of whom died in babyhood. "And even tremble at heavy traffic or quail at moving anything heavier than 20 pounds. My feminist self could return to school, complete a French minor, and earn a teaching degree." The last three of her children were born while she was teaching school. She talks about negotiating through the crowded hallways, hearing people whisper, "Is she pregnant again?" Or haven't they figured out how not to do it? Her reading list was like running down my own during the 1970s. Exponent 2, Sister Saints, Women's Voices, Betty Friedan's Second Stage, Annie Clark Tanner's A Mormon Mother. I would have also added Ms. Magazine and Dialogue. Judy and her husband visited the sculpture garden at Nauvoo, looking at the smoothly glossy, long-skirted bronze women created by Florence Hansen. They talk there about their ideals and realities. Judy presses Neil on the issue of whether women need a creative life, and half resentfully, he expresses his own ambiguities. "That's what I've always wanted for you, Judy. You know that. It's just that it doesn't work out in the real world. Something always has to give." Judy gives herself the last word, and the woman is usually the one who gives. Then she launches into that never-ending, always ambiguous internal conversation. At that point, they're no longer talking, about all of the messages about the happiness of sacrifice, the fulfillment of giving, the vice of wanting too much, but the unfairness of it, because it is usually women who feel guilty for wanting more out of life. Men who are dissatisfied with their opportunities or performance in a given area don't seem to feel guilty about wanting more. I always quietly resented the phrase, "The mother sets the tone of the home." Why the mother? Why not the father too? Why not the children as well? It seems to me we're all in this together. This, maybe that's the passage her children didn't like. This little passage plunged me straight back into the 70s and the challenges of being a Mormon feminist in a patriarchal church and negotiating guidelines for marriage in a way that honored the strength and gifts of both partners equally and fairly. My personal conviction is that nothing is more political than housework and childcare. I still feel that way. Were these the crisis issues only for my generation? It was wonderful to revisit them with Judy. For me, this book represents the spiritual strength that comes from asking good questions. Good questions about her own life and good questions about the lives of the pioneer women whose story she weaves into her own. And if you've read widely in 19th century Mormon women's writing, some of these will be familiar to you, but many will not. So it's really a good introduction to that body of literature too. So, the strength of questions is something integral to my spiritual journey. The second strength is, paradoxically, the strength of silence. Judy and I both read Annie Clark Tanner's telling autobiography, A Mormon Mother. I think that what most of us took away from this book on our first reading, how many of you have read it, by the way? Good. Is her restrained yet stinging indictment of polygamy and her love for her 11 children. But as I reread it, what sprang to my eye was not her initial conviction of Mormonism's truthfulness, which led her to espouse plural marriage, but the internal strength she developed that manifested itself in silence. Here are just a few examples. When Marion Tanner, one of her teachers at Brigham Young Academy and a married man, begins courting her, he says that it would be proper for her to write to him through his first wife. Annie says, "I felt that if polygamy were to begin in this way, it would end in failure, and consequently, there were no letters." Her silence won her the right to an independent relationship with her future husband. She describes her wedding in the endowment house, attended by the first wife, after which all three of them got on the train. "I got off at Farmington," Annie wrote, that was where her family lived, "and they went on to Ogden. I do not recall any conversation while on the train." In her own home, her sister asked, "Did it happen?" And Annie responded, "Ask me no questions." She sat down to her wedding supper of bread and milk, aware that there was no party, no celebration, not even a wedding gown, and definitely not a wedding night. "Finally, I broke the silence. The experience wasn't half bad," only to hear her father respond, "You haven't half begun yet." Marion married four more women, the third within 6 months, leaving Annie to wonder in silence, "Wherein I lacked that so soon he should take another wife." She gave birth to 11 children and spent most of the years between 1884 and 1890 on the underground, hiding from federal marshals with her children. It was primarily her father and brothers who helped her get a house, and the only time she seems to have spoken firmly against Marion's wishes was to insist, or spoken out at all for that matter, was to insist that the children get educations rather than staying in Canada to work his land there. A poignant moment came when her three-year-old twins had measles and one of them died. The first wife congratulated Annie on her fine control, meaning her silence during the funeral, because you made it easy for us. Annie did break her silence at that point. You didn't know that I could have screamed and blamed the neighbors for their indifference when they knew I had three sick children in the house, and the child's father, too, should have known that I needed help. She then reverted to silence. I was not permitted to discuss this great sorrow with Mr. Tanner. Obedience to the priesthood, to the authorities of the church, and to one's husband was paramount. It was his right to command. It was my duty to obey. Consequently, there was not so much outward discord, and when disaster came, as a result of this blind obedience, we had to accept it. The most telling test of her strength through silence came when he was leaving her house one Sunday morning when six of the children were still living at home. On his way down the steps, he announced he would not be visiting her anymore and that she should not expect any more financial assistance from him. Annie writes, "There had been no previous differences between us except the children's education, to which no reference had recently been made, so the statement was a great shock to me. Inwardly, I felt impelled to persuade him otherwise, and I was sure he expected me to. I nevertheless controlled myself and made no response to his far-reaching decision. My silence at the moment was not an easy thing, yet I am aware now that the years of the preceding struggle to live polygamy had all helped to steel me. I thought, I'll be equal to whatever must come. The separation was final. No further comment was made." I've reflected often on Annie's silence during the past 12 years of officially imposed silence, in at least some meetings, on me. I've learned something about the strength that comes from silence. The third book represents the spiritual strength of speaking out, and I illustrate it with Levi Peterson's Juanita Brooks, Mormon woman historian. Juanita Brooks is my hero for her staunch devotion to telling the truth of the Mountain Meadows Massacre and freeing the church from the official lies and half-truths that had fastened blood guilt upon all of us. She also, almost single-handedly, brought us a truer measure of John D. Lee, scapegoated as the sole villain for the crime. I think it's ironic that reviewers of this book criticized Levi for devoting so much attention to Juanita's domestic chores, her large family, her numerous church callings, and her helpfulness to neighbors. For me, the dailiness of Juanita's life make her efforts to also be a historian a consecrated effort. Her moment of most intense conflict with the institutional church came when Eddie Lee, a daughter of John D. Lee, told her that after strenuous efforts by the family, President David O. McKay had authorized John D. Lee's posthumous reinstatement and restoration of blessings. Juanita immediately planned to add this information to the introduction of her biography of Lee, which was then at her publisher's. Levi notes, "It was more than a restitution for the disgraced pioneer. It was a personal vindication for Juanita, who had for years suffered a shadowy disgrace among her conservative friends and relatives for having espoused his cause. By reinstating Lee, the church had tacitly admitted that Juanita's accusations against Brigham Young were correct, and needless to say, the church did not want to call attention to its reversal of field on this issue. So quite typically, in my humble opinion, the church's first action was to apply indirect pressure on Juanita through men. According to Apostle Delbert L. Stapley, David O. McKay told him he was so upset that Juanita was planning to publish this confidential information that he was considering rescinding the reinstatement. For what it's worth, I called Greg Prince to check this point. His new biography of David O. McKay is on sale at the table, I noticed. And he tells a wonderful story that I won't go into here about some of the behind-the-scenes effort. But I specifically asked Greg, because it wasn't clear from the book itself, what President McKay's diary said about this episode, and it said nothing. President McKay did not record conversations with Stapley on this point. So I suspect that Stapley either made it up or greatly exaggerated what he saw as an assignment from David O. McKay. That's been known to happen before. Stapley immediately passed this threat, which obviously lost nothing in the retelling, to Jesse Udall, a stake president, justice of the Arizona State Supreme Court, and the husband of John D. Lee's granddaughter. Got those credentials. He assigned Eddie Lee to rein in Juanita. Juanita courageously accepted the possibility that she herself would be excommunicated, but argued that President McKay would not be so unjust to John D. Lee. She finally agreed to omit the information from the first edition, designed primarily for the family, but refused to make a further commitment. Thinking that a second edition would be years in the future, Eddie reluctantly accepted this compromise. Stapley then threatened Juanita directly in a personal meeting in his office. She says she spoke to him as one person to another, not as a humble member to an apostle of the Lord. She made her strongest arguments, including the fact that the news was already widely known, but he repeated over and over, like a broken Victrola record, the words, "If this appears in print anywhere, in the book, on the jacket, in a review, President McKay will rescind the action." Juanita refused to make any other promise than the one she had already made to Eddie, so Jesse Udall intensified the pressure. At a meeting in Jesse's home, Juanita listened to a series of testimonies by a host of male Lee descendants, most of whom were bishops or other leaders in their stakes or wards, along the lines that President McKay was God's mouthpiece on earth, and that if we did not obey his demands, he would rescind the earlier action. Juanita was not allowed to speak until everyone else was finished. At that point, she bore her own testimony of the gospel, citing her spiritual experiences, her years and years of church service, and the fact that she had a temple recommend. A second round of speech follows. She insisted on saying no. There is no question that we all, and the second edition was published with that information in it, the introduction. There is no question that we all know what owe Juanita Brooks a great debt of gratitude, not only for writing the truth about this troublesome and troubling episode in Mormon history, but for so courageously and staunchly resisting threats, pressure, intimidation, and pleas to capitulate to official disapproval. One of the most moving documents that came out of this crisis was an eloquent letter from Juanita to Jesse Udall. "I do think that as an honest historian, as I have tried to be, I owe it to myself and to my readers to tell all the truth, for truth suppressed is its own kind of a lie. So to protect your integrity and to help you keep your word," meaning his assurances to Stapley that the information would not be published, "I must act the part of a prevaricator myself in that I fail to use important and pertinent information or deliberately pretend that I do not have it. This is a role which I do not enjoy playing." The stories and experiences of these women strengthen my spirit and are important stepping stones on my spiritual journey. The spiritual strength that comes from asking hard and complicated questions, as Judy Busk's book does. The spiritual strength that comes from silence, as Annie Clark Tanner's book records, and the spiritual strength that comes from speaking out in defense of the truth, as Juanita Brooks' books do. Thank you.
Budding feminist consciousness even as a child, realizing that the world wasn't quite fair to females. I remember my own first feminist spiritual experience, I think, was one day after church. I went home and took my little play dishes and put bread on them and passed bread around to everybody in the living room and told them I was practicing passing the sacrament. As I got older, I came of age in the 60s, graduating from high school about 3 years after Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique. I didn't read it until I was in my early 20s in the early 1970s, but I was certainly aware by that time of the growing feminist movement. Even while I was diligently attempting to suppress my feminist thoughts in deference to my patriarchal religion. By the late 1960s, I was a young mother of two small children with a growing awareness of the fact that my sense of myself was at odds with the church's insistence on a prescription for the course of my life. By the time the church correlated the Relief Society in the early 1970s, I was beginning to feel very stifled by the church. It was about that time that I discovered Carolyn Pearson's book, The Flight and the Nest. Mary Ellen mentioned her second book, Daughters of Light, which was about largely about women's Mormon women's spiritual experiences. The Flight and the Nest dealt more with their accomplishments in secular society. Early Utah was not a secular society, but it dealt a lot with women's professional accomplishments. And that was the first time I was aware of the really rich heritage of strong women that I had as a Mormon woman. And a little bit like Carolyn said, when she discovered Woman's Exponent, she was simultaneously thrilled at the discovery, but also angry that nobody ever told her this before. And I felt very much the same way, sort of betrayed by the fact that this information had been kept from me. I was already well acquainted with Carolyn's poetry when I read The Flight and the Nest, and then when I read The Flight and the Nest, I knew I'd found a soulmate. I went on to also read Daughters of Light. And The Flight and the Nest gave me, and Daughters of Light also, gave me great hope that there was a place within the LDS Church for women's spiritual power and expression. I still hadn't grasped the idea that there was something that could be identified as women's spirituality that might be different from sort of a male model of spirituality that I was presented with in the church. But I knew that I was not being spiritually fed by my patriarchal church, and I had not heard of the book that Mary Ellen mentioned, Spiritual Hunger and Feminist Thirst, but I like the title, and I think that title would have resonated very deeply with me had it been written back then. About that time, the church came out against the Equal Rights Amendment. And the church's anti-ERA activities really caused kind of a major break for me with any sense that I might have had that the church would ever affirm my sense of spirituality as a woman. And it caused me to question whether I really believed in God in general, or Christianity in particular, or the church, the LDS Church, even more particularly. And I struggled with that for a while. And it was in the early to mid-70s at that point, and there was not a lot of information out there. Or if there was, like Carolyn, it was not available to me. And so I was sort of struggling through this alone. And then in the late 70s, a friend of mine gave me a copy of, not a book, but Len Swidler's article, Jesus Was a Feminist. He's a Catholic theologian. And after giving it considerable thought, I determined that while Jesus might not fit a modern day description of feminist, he was at least affirming of women and of women's religious life. And that was a really sort of a major boost in my sense that I could remain a Christian, remain a Mormon, and find a meaningful sense of spirituality within the traditions that I had been born into. Later, I was taking a religion class at San Jose State, and there was a woman there, and I don't remember her name. She is a published author, but I don't remember what her name was. But she came into the class, and she was talking about her spiritual journey, and also at San Jose State at that time, Carol Crist, author or editor of Woman Spirit Rising, was teaching there. And this woman talked about women who had broken with Christianity and had gone on to find spiritual fulfillment in other kinds of spiritual journeys. And I remember her saying that she was happy for them that they could do that, but for her, she needed to find spirituality within her own traditions. And I felt very much the same way at that time. By the early 1980s, I had begun to look at what women were writing about in their own religious journeys. There were many more books available at that time, and I stopped in at the San Jose State Bookstore and found Woman Spirit Rising. And I was really elated to learn about how women were successfully challenging the rules in their own patriarchal churches and having success at getting accepted into ministerial functions. And I had forgotten Mary Ellen, but I also read that book, When Women Were Priests. And it had completely slipped my mind, but that was also a book that helped me along on this journey. Also, about this same time, I met Carol Lynn through a mutual friend, and I remember one day I was having a conversation with her on the telephone about women's religious issues, and she told me about the book When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone, which I also immediately went out and purchased, and it broadened my view of the evolution of religion in the ancient world. And it wasn't too much longer after that that I read Elaine Pagel's book, The Gnostic Gospels, which was a translation of the early Gnostic texts that had been found at Nag Hammadi, and they were ancient texts from the early Christian movement, the Gnostics, which were considered heretics, but which I feel represented an authentic strain of Christianity in the early world, even though it's not the one that survived as the official church. And in reading all these books, I came to understand how women's spirituality and women's expression of their religiosity within Christianity had been suppressed, but that it really was a long-standing tradition. There were a number of other books that I read that I got from the library and that I've long since forgotten the titles of. But I was able to continue to read some of those books that described women's journeys in mostly Christian or Judeo-Christian religions. I hoped that Maxine Hank's book, Women in Authority, as well as the many other books that were coming out, but by this time I'd sort of moved on to the 1990s, and I was aware of the Mormon Sisters in Spirit. I had those books on my shelf, but I somehow got busy and didn't read them. But when I was first looking for books about Mormon women and religion, there was very little to be found. And as the books came out, I sort of devoured every one of them. And then they started coming out so fast I couldn't keep up anymore. And there are many books out there now. But I hope that these books, and then by the time we'd gotten to Maxine Hank's book on women and authority, I still held out hope that these kinds of writings, these books, would make a difference within the church. And by the time Maxine was excommunicated and her book didn't really seem to matter to the institutional church, and nor did Margaret and Paul Toscano's book, Strangers in Paradox, I started sort of losing hope that there was going to be any kind of affirmation of women's spirituality within the church in my lifetime. So my hopes were pretty much dashed. Somewhat like the saying on a Potshots postcard that I saw once, I've now given up my search for truth and I'm searching for a meaningful fantasy. The most recent enjoyable book along that line was Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. I occasionally notice synchronicities in my life, thanks to Carol Lynn, but largely content myself now with a little introspection and a lot of the joy of living and loving and doing. Que sera, sera.
All right, well, that wraps up the panelist part, and what I'd like to do is start passing out copies of the book list for people who want them. And while I'm doing that, if you have questions or comments, anything you'd like to ask the panelists about the books that they've talked about, please feel free to come up and speak into the microphone so that the questions and comments get on the tape. So come on up.
One of the books you mentioned, Mary Ellen, I mean, one of the authors you mentioned, Karen Armstrong. I just finished her Muhammad biography yesterday. Amazing woman. I had a grandmother who was the granddaughter of Bathsheba W. Smith, whose funeral was held in the tabernacle. My own grandmother's funeral was held in the assembly hall with the First Presidency preaching her funeral, and she lived with us. She was an artist and an art dealer. She was a legislator and put the University of Utah up on the hill. One time she went to an international congress of women in Berlin. She was booed off the stage because they heard she was from Utah. The chairman of the international convention came out and chewed the audience out, told them what a great person my grandmother was. So my grandmother resumed speaking, and they liked her speech so much they had her speak the next day also. We used to have her first cousin, George Albert Smith, the president of the church, over for dinner now and then. And usually what would happen is after the dinner, he would say to her, Alice Merrill Horn, I wonder if you'd give me a blessing. And he'd sit in a chair in the living room, and she'd stand behind him and put her hands on his head and give him a blessing. And as a child, that seemed like the perfectly normal thing that was supposed to happen. She was the matriarch. She was the head person, even greater than the president of the church. So I just thought I'd pass along that to you. It was supposed to be Harriet Arrington, my first cousin, and then Leonard died. He was researching her life with Harriet at the in the various libraries in Utah, but unfortunately Leonard died before they got it off the ground. Presently, one of my friends is going to write a biography of Leonard, and. As for Harriet, I guess I've got to call her and talk to her about what we're going to do about that.
It's a story that needs to be told.
Sure.
I am Mormon feminine. There is a lack of women of color, their voice in contemporary feminism, and I just, especially Mormon feminism, and I wondered if you could say a little bit, something about, you know, what that means, and maybe the future, what we're missing by having those, not having those voices.
It's true that there isn't a lot, and that if you say contemporary, you sort of have to define what period, but that's a very good question. I think Helen Sequoptata's I've left out a syllable. She's a Navajo woman who wrote Me and Mine with the assistance of Helen, I think, Hudal. It's the story of it's the story of a Mormon Navajo woman. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. I think that someone who is currently writing right now, and usually writing from a fairly autobiographical perspective, is Chieko Okazaki. Even though her books are collections of her talks, I think that they're very self-revelatory and very empowering. I don't think there's anything defensive about them. It's like she doesn't know that women aren't supposed to say the things she says, and Deseret Book doesn't know that it's not supposed to be publishing them. So... So I think a good time is being had by all. A couple of autobiographical works by African American Mormon women are Mary Sterlagson's. She did one under her maiden name and another one under her married name, A Soul So Rebellious, and. Does anyone remember the other one? It picks up another line from that same song. Both of them were published by Deseret Book, as I recall. And there's a book that's out of print now that Laura W. Bush, treats in her Faithful Transgressions, which just came out last year from the University of Nevada Press, I believe. That's by Wynetta Martin, who joined the church as a convert before the revelation on blacks, and wrote this memoir as a sort of explanation to her parents, who were, I believe, Baptists, about why she would join a racist, discriminatory, prejudiced organization like Mormonism. And she did it basically because she had a first vision type of experience. So there are a few places where you could read something that I think, and all of these works are stirring. They're really wonderful.
Yeah, and I'll acknowledge that perspective definitely is missing from the book list that you now have in hand. And I thank Levina for filling in some of the blanks, but I know that we just don't have as much there. You know, I mean, we look around the room, and there aren't a whole lot of women of color here, and we're not hearing their stories, and that's definitely something I'd like to hear more about. Yeah.
I just like to follow up on that and ask Levina. I'm not familiar with any of those books, and although they're written by women, do they have a feminist perspective at all? I mean, not to denigrate any spiritual experience they have, but I'm just wondering if within that body of literature of women of color, Chieko Okazaki's books certainly have a feminist perspective. But I am familiar with hers. But on the other ones, would you say they're feminist?
Well, I think they are in the sense that they all have to negotiate a place for themselves as Mormon women who were converts. All converts,
yeah,
within a patriarchal institution. So they noticed.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
Did they notice?
I think that they have a way of a discourse of talking about it in a way that is not perhaps the way we would talk about it now.
Uh-huh.
But they do notice.
Okay.
I am appalled at how many LDS women do not know what Exponent 2 is. In all my wards, I mentioned it to the, you know, at Relief Society. They've never heard of it. And I say, well, I go to the retreats in New Hampshire, and I can't. Sometimes I don't even want to talk to them about it. So if you haven't heard of it, I can't talk to you. There is a gentleman who's a physician that's in Mill Valley that he's written a book. And Carolyn, you might have to help me with this, and maybe you. God or God versus the Alphabet, Leonard Shalalan. He did a book tour here, and he came to Sonoma, and I heard him speak. And I purchased his book, and I let someone borrow it before I read it. But basically, it's about how in early times women were revered as priests, and they were put on pedestals and they were revered for their godlike qualities and for the things that they could pronounce and things. And then the printing press came about and silenced women, and how the Catholic Church came about and Martin Luther came and men were able to silence women. It's just this fascinating read. So I hope it's something about God versus the alphabet anyway. But and I just want to pose this question out to you, and then maybe you can come up to me, you know, during the dinner break or something. But I am appalled about how many LDS women cannot stand Hillary Clinton. And I will mention her, you know, to my LDS women friends. They'll say, "Oh, she's my hero," and they'll go, "Oh, she's a lesbian. Oh, she's evil," and I say, "Why? She's articulate. She's smart. When she speaks, I just am enthralled because she's so intelligent. She holds herself so well. She travels the world and she speaks so well. She presents herself so beautifully. What's not to like about her? When she writes, she's an eloquent author. Why wouldn't you want your daughters and your sons to revere her and to be like her?" And I have a cousin in Mesa who's Temple marriage. Her husband has sexually been unfaithful to her, and she has decided to remain in this marriage, which is her decision, and it's fine. And she's decided to stick by her man. Well, so did Hillary. So what's the difference here? You know, that's their own, because she's a Democrat. But I just am appalled by all these LDS women that think she's evil, and you know, I'm just appalled. Is that what it is? I find that to be so sad. Anyway, thank you.
I'm not keen on gender stereotyping, but I'm curious about the panel's having researched this topic and that sort of thing and read extensively. Do you have a sense of a female versus a male spirituality, or do you think it's all one and the same, or how would you respond to that? Is there a female spirituality as opposed to a male spirituality? I mean, I'm not keen on those sorts of distinctions, but... Or are we just talking the ability to express it or not?
I probably personally agree with what you're suggesting here. And when I would maybe use that phrase or get into the subject, it would be just rediscovering the fact that women have had powerful spiritual lives. I don't know that there would be much of a difference between how men and women really experience the divine, a gender ability that women don't have. But I think in general, we're not that different. So I'm not crazy about saying, you know, here's a female spirituality. In fact, I find myself kind of withdrawing from what today seem to be, you know, the Wicca pagan kind of thing that is kind of exclusively feminine. That doesn't really appeal to me. I want something that is very much available to both men and women, realizing that we won't experience exactly the same as the other one. But I don't like to have much of a division in the vocabulary there.
Well, one thing that was kind of interesting, that's a tangent, I think, to what you bring up. In my research for my thesis on women's spiritual activities, in the early days of the church, women weren't doing things all that differently from the men. It seemed like they were going along these parallel tracks. You know, men were giving blessings and healing sick people. Women were giving blessings and healing sick people. And you know, maybe the women were a little bit more focused on, you know, blessing each other prior to giving birth, because the practice then was you actually laid hands on the afflicted part, and, you know, that could get weird if, you know, your home teacher back in the, you know, 1830s was doing that. But they really were moving a long time. There wasn't really months until priesthood authority started becoming more and more defined and more solidified. And then all of a sudden giving healing blessings was increasingly identified with being a priesthood activity. And as I think one of the panelists mentioned, women started asking, is it okay if we do this? Pretty please, is it all right? And then they'd get the answer, well, you can give a blessing, but you can't seal it like the men do. And so then, you know, what women were doing began to erode away, kind of at their own asking in some ways. So I don't think that there was, you know, in the early church at least, not a significant difference in these two particular activities, healing blessings and speaking in tongues. There wasn't, you know, a male version and a female version of that. You know, men and women were both doing that. But I think as time and various other forces came together, that ceased to happen in parallel. And I think there became more of a division between, you know, what women might, you know, what a female or woman-centered spirituality may have looked like versus what the men were doing. And I think, you know, definitely in sort of the public activities of women and men, you know, they started going on separate tracks, you know, around about that same time. So that answers things. We've got time for a couple more questions or comments.
I really don't know the details of Sidney Rigdon's conceptualization of the female priesthood. He defined it as a separate entity from the Melchizedek priesthood, but I really don't know the details. He departed from the early Mormon view, which was not bifurcated. The early Mormon view of Joseph Smith and others who talked about what Joseph Smith had taught them was that women had a priesthood, no different from the male priesthood of Melchizedek, that men received in ordination, but that women received it through the endowment. Sidney Rigdon taught something different from that. I mean, he bifurcated that there is a female priesthood and that there is a male priesthood. But I don't really remember reading the scriptural or the ideological, the theological basis for his making that split. But it was different, as far as I am aware, from what Joseph Smith taught, which was that there was a unitary priesthood, and the Melchizedek really included all. The Melchizedek included the Aaronic, and that women had access to the Melchizedek just as males did.
Oh, just one footnote I'd like to add about my grandmother. When they held this Berlin conference, the lady who chewed out the audience and got her back on the stage was Susan B. Anthony. And every time Susan B. Anthony came through Utah, well, my grandmother and her friends would present her with a new silk dress.
Anyone?